Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, July 9th. Days after what's been described as the largest storm to hit the area, covering some 600 miles, we are learning about the damage left behind from Super Typhoon Bobby. We hear from a journalist from the tiny island of Rota that took a direct hit. And you could call it a report on solar published by the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization gets pulled back. We explore why. We continue to explore the business of golf. We hear more details about a new Play Hawaii Golf initiative. Plus, some Hawaii drivers are sporting a new look in their wallets. The city just mailed out a bunch of the new licenses. We hear about the redesign. What do motorists think? And we spotlight a new podcast that HPR is rolling out. It's called Kanakapila Vintage, What is Old is New Again.
Support for HPR comes from Ho'ola Napua, working to prevent child trafficking through public education about buyer demand and the community's role in reducing exploitation. Resources at ho'olanapua.org.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Here in Hawaii, we have been fortunate to have been affected by so few powerful hurricanes, but more storm systems are forecast this season. And this morning, we looked to the Western Pacific to see what a Category 5 storm can do. Just how bad can it be? The island of Rota, part of the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, took a direct hit from Super Typhoon Bobby this week. It packed winds of up to 180 miles an hour, and it was big. It's been described as the largest storm system stretching out over an area as large as the entire country of France or covering an area from New York to Florida. Thomas Manglotnia is with the Marianas Press. He lives in Saipan, but is originally from Rota. He was able to fly over on Wednesday to see the destruction firsthand on his home island. Initial official reports from the area indicate that just about every structure has been damaged or destroyed by the violent winds.
Right now, the situation is dire on Rota for drinking water. Thankfully, they did repair a main water pipe line break yesterday. The U.S. military was able to go in and restore water to most homes, if not all at this point in time. As you know, we were hit by Super Typhoon Sinlaku just 3 months ago. Rota sustained some damage, but most of that damage from the Super Typhoon was to Saipan and Tinian. This time around, Rota was a direct hit from Super Typhoon Bobby, getting winds of up to 180 miles per hour. It's a devastating situation on the ground, Catherine. And this is one of the worst storms to hit Rota in recent memory.
Yes. And, you know, I was just recalling my worst memory of a super typhoon. We were without power for 3 months and without water for a month. And I just found out that folks on Saipan, some of my brother-in-law's family, they still don't have power from April.
Yes, that is so true. In fact, some people who were just connected 3 days ago or up to 2 weeks ago now don't have power again because of Bavi. And so our infrastructure is hard hit. Even on the island of Tinian, they're talking about having to replace the entire power plant. They have to replace the entire source of power generation on Tinian because it was damaged so badly. And so right now they're using some generators from the U.S. military and whatever they have online. And so, yeah, we're a community now that has survived multiple natural catastrophe amid a super El Nino year that will only bring more typhoons in the coming months. Of course, we hope they're not super typhoons.
Yes, and I think that's the thing that we're trying to underscore to people. Look at how bad it can get, you know? So you take these storm systems seriously, listen to what officials say to hunker down, because, you know, growing up in that area, right, Typhoon Alley, the people just become resilient. They know what to do. And so that way you're trying to minimize the loss of life, injuries, that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, you know, right before the storm hit us, we were very concerned about those who received tents from FEMA. They distributed around 1,400 tents after Super Typhoon Sinlaku. And this time around for Super Typhoon Bobby, we saw about 500 people go to the shelter. All the shelters were at capacity. And so The big question I think everyone is asking now is, how do we create a sustainable infrastructure, a sustainable way of life? Because we saw in this recent typhoon, we were still recovering and we all had to jump into preparation mode. I mean, how do you prepare when your roof is gone? How do you prepare? It's an impossible question. And so I think many people are also asking, how can the federal government assist people to not just put temporary roofs on their homes, but to help build back better truly that will sustain the next super typhoon? And so, yes, we are focused on the immediate needs now. We need water, we need shelter, we need power, but also we need a solution for the long term, Catherine. It's just becoming unsustainable. And every time we hear of another disturbance brewing in Micronesia, we all get really fearful. There's even a disturbance forming right now, and hopefully it stays a disturbance. But we are in a really difficult situation, and I don't know how families will bounce back. I don't know how we'll get our tourism economy back. There needs to be a major paradigm shift in the weeks to come.
Well, when I first moved here to Honolulu, my neighbor was the head of Hawaiian Rock and Cement, and he was proud of the fact that he helped design the concrete structures to withstand typhoon condition winds. And, you know, I know it's expensive, but I do recall also being in a concrete house, and during the super typhoon back in 76, the wall started to crack, you know, so you have to wonder, where do we go if it won't withstand those types of conditions?
Yes. And to put it into perspective, we're just starting the process of issuing disaster nutrition assistance. We were in that process when the super typhoon came. And so now our population's in a scenario where we will be applying for programs and assistance for two disasters at one time. And Lord help us if there's a third one on the way. And so right now for Rota, especially, the nonprofit organizations are focused on getting drinking water there. In fact, right now I'm in multiple group chats about sending water from Guam, from Saipan. But the unique thing about Rota in particular, you know, it's an island per the last census populated by 1,700 people. It's probably less than that now since people have left. But they also don't have a lot of the infrastructure that Saipan has in terms of hotel rooms or houses for federal officials to come in. And so what the mayor told me yesterday is that these federal officials will be flying in the morning and leaving at night. And so there is a unique logistical challenge, especially because, for example, the seaport was heavily damaged in the last storm and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was there yesterday assessing, but the seaports might take a while. But luckily, air relief, air cargo has already begun starting yesterday. And so there's a bit of a logistical challenge on Rota. You know, for example, even the grocery stores have limited inventory items, right? There are several organizations that might want to donate money directly to give out grocery vouchers, for example, but also want to not empty the shelves, right? They want to figure out how to do it in a sustainable way as well. So very difficult, long road ahead, but the region is coming together, and also those in Hawaii, those in the States, I know they're already organizing to get containers here and to already start fundraising money, because sometimes those containers can take weeks to get here. And so sending something now can take a few weeks, while donating directly to nonprofits, they can mobilize resources on the ground through your monetary donation.
Yes, and I know, I think Red Cross folks staging to be able to fly out. And I think the flights have resumed to Guam. I actually fly out Friday. So yeah, we'll see if I have power or water. But water is the main thing. It's so critical. Yeah,
absolutely. After Super Typhoon Sinlaku, I was without water for about 18 days. And that was the shorter end of the wait time of people here in the Marianas. And so I'm grateful for the island of Rota. They got water back up basically within the 24 hours of the all clear, or right around that. And so people have water, but again, drinking water is still very much an urgent need at this point in time.
Yeah, if your water went out, you got to boil it. But then if you don't have power, and then you've got to just, yeah, rough it. And then
if you don't have butane gas for those gas stoves, and also there's some different regulations around, you can't just like ship butane gas, you know, on a plane, right?
And then so in comparison, like how small is Rota compared to Guam?
Guam has a population of 150,000 and Rota has a population of around 1,500. And so it's a small community, and my home did sustain damages yesterday. It was quite tragic to go in and see, my mom's outdoor kitchen all flow away. We had, several doors and windows blow in. And one thing, Catherine, even if people wanted to get ready on Rota, they ran out of plywood. So you couldn't even buy what you needed to board up properly. And so, Rota has those challenges.
We've been hearing from Thomas Manglotnio with the Marianas Press. His home island of Rota was hit hard by Super Typhoon Bobby.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Lisa Miller had trouble conceiving a child, so she prayed to a higher power for help.
The most important center of my life, our family, was born out of a dialogue with the deeper force of all life.
Why people turn to spirituality. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Here on The Conversation, you first heard about how a new report on green energy published by UHERO, the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization, was raising some eyebrows. Honolulu Civil Beat wrote about it, and just this week, the report got pulled. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us to talk about why. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what did you find? Share with our listeners.
Yes, so this is a report that was authored by Michael Roberts, who's an economics professor and a fellow at the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization. And he published this report on UHERO's website on June 29th, so really recently. And pretty immediately, this paper started to get attention, and a lot of it was critical. With this report, Roberts had waded into what was one of the biggest energy debates happening on Oahu right now, which is whether we should build a new plant that burns natural gas instead of oil for power to try to lower our energy costs. And Robert argued that we don't need a new LNG plant, nor do we need any other kinds of new firm generation. We just need a bunch more solar. And Robert said he rushed to publish in part because these policy questions felt urgent, but in doing so, he overlooked multiple errors. One was flagged by Hawaiian Electric, where Roberts had mislabeled some solar costs, and he quickly issued a correction to that, but he told me that in doing so, he actually opened the door to a bigger mistake. He used AI, and it gave him incorrect information.
I screwed up in responding to that too quickly and said something that just wasn't right. I leaned on the AI assistant and did not check what it wrote. And it looked right to me. So that was a big mistake. And so gave me some pause, I guess. I feel really bad about that. And I especially feel bad about my colleagues, especially if it reflects poorly on them. Again, I don't think that has any bearing on any of the conclusions of the report, but I did say something that just wasn't right. So I feel bad about that.
So what did the AI tell Roberts?
So the AI assistant, specifically Claude, that's what he was using, summarized a legitimate report, but it summarized it incorrectly. It told Roberts that contract prices for solar and storage projects were flat to falling between 2018 and 2024. And that showed up in the report. In reality, the opposite was true. Those prices doubled during that time, and Roberts didn't catch that mistake. And so when he did recognize it, he started an internal audit of the report, and he found additional errors, including one that presents a proposed liquefied natural gas project by JERA as more expensive than it actually is. And Roberts says he's fairly confident that the fundamental conclusions of his report won't change and that solar will still bear out as the most cost-effective strategy for Oahu. But he's made the decision in the meantime to withdraw the report, and he's crunching all those numbers again before publishing a revised edition.
Now that it's got lots of attention, maybe we can get the best peer review ever. And we want to invite all these people out there who are criticizing it to, you know, come to us. Tell us what you'd like. You know, we can run other scenarios, make other assumptions, just... If you think that there's any particular problems or you want us to do anything else, then let us know what those are, and we'll, you know, look at this much more carefully and vet it more carefully, and then reissue it when we're sure it's bulletproof or as bulletproof as we can make it.
You have to wonder, you know, what kind of vetting did they do?
Right. So this gets into how UHERO is structured, and that's something that I talked about with their director, Carl Bonham. So UHERO, it's an esteemed research institution, and its name carries a lot of weight. There are actually only a handful of UHERO faculty. And so when those folks publish a report, like their economic forecast, for instance, it is reflective of the organization's official position on a topic. And additionally, UHERO has a lot of fellows, many of them who are university faculty, like Michael Roberts, and they publish on UHERO's websites as well. But if you read one of their reports, you'll see a note that says, the views of this report, expressed in this report, are the authors, not of UHERO. That is kind of tricky to find unless you really go looking for it. And those reports don't get the same level of internal vetting. So Bonham acknowledged that since everything gets published on their website, it can be a distinction that's really easy to miss. UHERO is currently working on putting new procedures in place to better vet these papers.
To, you know, rely on the academic integrity and the academic care that a faculty member is going to bring to a subject automatically. But for much of what we do, that's not enough, and so we're you know, looking at how can we improve those systems without making things so onerous that we never publish anything, right? Because you can go so far that nothing ever gets published because you're just worried about making mistakes. And it's not, you know, we're not worried about making mistakes. What we're worried about is not correcting them, right? We want to get it right, and so I think this really reflects that attention to detail, maybe a little bit too late. Undoubtedly, it would have been better if we had done a much more careful vetting and communications with stakeholders in advance. And we're going to try to make sure that there's an institutional process that makes that happen where appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with economists who deal with numbers, right? And you want to get those numbers right.
Certainly. And I think that the other thing that Carl Bonham emphasizes, since this is a topic that is of such importance, and there has been a lot of materials that have come out around it on both sides, before this report is reissued, he would really like to see stakeholder outreach to the Hawaii State Energy Office, to JERA, perhaps, which has the LNG project in question. And as Michael Roberts said, he's looking for feedback from those parties as well.
Yes, and I recall the Energy Office had some egg on its face when its report had errors. But yeah, thanks so much, Savannah, for checking into this.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. We we've been hearing or exploring the business of golf this week following the announcement by the PGA Tour to convert Wailea Sony Open into a championship tournament for ages 50 and up. We heard from former golf pro and sports commentator Mark Rolfing and Honolulu Star Advertiser columnist David Reardon yesterday. Today, we explore the campaign announced by a dozen golf resorts called Play Hawaii Golf. We spoke with Greg Nichols, director of Ko'olina Golf Club. He says the industry-led initiative will tap sports celebrities and more to get their message out globally.
What ultimately transpired was, with the loss of the Century and then the loss of the Sony Open, you know, we realized that was going to really create a major impact, negative impact for the state, not only for the golf industry, but for the entire industry in terms of the economic impact and the social impact, you know, from the charitable aspect of it, you know, Friends of Hawaii Charities and how much they do, how much the Century gave back to Maui. And so we saw a need to try to band together and try to, create this, which is really a kind of a marketing co-op or a marketing hooey, if you will, to try to address that the challenges that were coming from the loss of those tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you felt you had to step up because you couldn't just stand on the sidelines and just watch.
No, well, we're operators. PGA professionals and general managers that were involved, we see it day to day. And, you know, we're very grateful to the groups like HVCB and HTA for what they've done to try to market golf. And yet, you know, there was a real need. And who better than the folks that are, you know, in the trenches, if you will, day to day that really understand golf. And we've got about 80-plus golf courses in the state. And, you know, the economic impact to the state is about $3.5 billion, Catherine. So it's significant. And, beyond the economic impact, it's just the social impact that the game brings. There's so many different benefits from playing golf beyond the economics. I mean, it's really the open spaces. It's the time spent with your family and your friends and loved ones. And, we already talked about the charitable aspect, but golf is a really great sport for health and wellness. I mean, are you a golfer, Catherine? I
am not, but, I'm just trying to figure out how you plan to spread the word globally. I mean, had mentioned this with our conversation with Mark Rolfing and Dave Reardon, being out there at a Wailea, and I had to cover Michelle Wee out there, right? And she was such a young phenom at the time, and that was so exciting. And I learned a lot, having this conversation with Rolfing and how he was able to try and put that deal together to get the seniors in there. So it's really opened my eyes. But how do you get the word out globally?
Well, as you know, you're in the media business, so it's in a variety of different ways, both with print media, with via television. The internet is probably the greatest single means digitally. But also, what we see is through social media, Instagram and Facebook and all of those platforms are tremendous now for driving, awareness of golf. We talk about the TV. We'll be running, advertising via the Golf Channel, via other tournaments and things like that. But, the greatest single thing, I think, with social media, people don't trust advertising as much as they trust their neighbor and what they're telling them. And we know that Hawaii has always been one of the premier golf destinations in the world. Well, we're going to let the people that play golf tell the story for us. When I'm really excited to share with you some of the celebrities that have come on board to try to share their story. You mentioned Michelle Wee. Michelle is going to be one of our, I don't want to call them ambassadors, because Michelle's always been an ambassador for Hawaii golf, but other professionals, Park McLaughlin, who's now the short game chef, he's coming on board.
Awesome.
Xander Schauffele, who lives on Kauai, Xander's offered to help and spread the word and do, record spots on what do they love most about Hawaii golf? Why is Hawaii golf special? What makes living in Hawaii and playing in Hawaii so special? We're also, how about this, Catherine? You may not be a golfer, but I know you love movies, and as I do. And Pierce Brosnan. Pierce Brosnan is one of the individuals that wants to help. And so
that's great.
Yeah,
Kauai resident.
So I think, he loves Kauai. and it's people like that. I mean, we know that Hawaii touches so many people that have the opportunity to visit here, beyond the sports celebrities and TV celebrities and et cetera. So we're hoping to tap into them, but mostly tap into the great stories that Hawaii has. We've got 12 of the top resorts that are part of this HUI that will be starting forward, but we'll also be engaging all of the wonderful hotel properties, again, from the Four Seasons to the Ritz-Carltons of the world, to the Hiltons of the world, to the Marriotts of the world, and they will also see a direct benefit from bringing in the golfers.
And we also got a chance to check in with Alex Nakajima, the general manager of Kapalua Golf. He talked to Addis Balai, our summer intern, about joining the initiative.
I took the ball because we were in the middle of a PGA Tour event going away from Kapalua. And I know Kapalua is one of the larger golf resorts in Hawaii, and we provided significant amount of energy to the state economic engine impact. So with the tournament loss, we were nervous about what the future will bring and the loss of exposure. And I also understand other parts of the world, strong golf destinations are popping up in South Carolina or Mexico, Cabo, Bahamas. And we need to stay strong and make sure Hawaii is an attractive destination for all the visitors who's thinking about vacationing into Hawaii. And we want to be front and center. So this is an effort for collaboratively all of us to put our funds together and then send our message to the mainland.
And for those of us who don't play golf or don't go to golf courses regularly, what makes golfing in Hawaii particularly so special as opposed to those other places you mentioned, like the Carolinas and such?
I think first things comes to mind is the beauty. We have ocean, green lush vegetation, and then the mountainous climate. We have so many varieties of golf courses here on the islands. And as you know, each island are so beautiful and different. And who wouldn't want to come over here if you're a golfer or a vacationer? And golf is just a one of the activities when people travel to Hawaii. There are so many other activities, but it's also important that golfing type of family or people are generally, they will buy and dine out better than others. And, you know, these are the important customers for the hotel, too. So it was a perfect match. We have a direct contact with these clienteles. And then, our efforts, I believe, will go long ways to market Hawaii, state of Hawaii.
What are, like, the long-term goals of Play Hawaii Golf? Because I know you mentioned, you know, getting more people to come down, play at the courses. Is that kind of what you guys are envisioning, or maybe something more?
Well, there's an interesting loop. If we do well, if the golf course receives a lot of the benefit out of this effort, I think people definitely need a place to stay. So hotels will benefit, and then dining outlets, restaurants will benefit, car rental, airlines, and so on. And we also have an investment back to our future local communities. So what we're thinking is part of the revenue will go back to the Hawaii State Junior Golf Association or local junior associations to invest into the future of the business, because that's our future, right? They'll be playing golf along the way. So we want to complete that cycle. It's not just for golf. It's for entire industry and the locals as well.
We've been hearing from general managers at Ko'olina and Kapalua's golf courses. A dozen resort and golf clubs are taking the initiative to launch Play Hawaii Golf.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. In Divine Disruption, The Art of Tseren Chirpa, the Nepalese artist explores issues such as migration and identity. Now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, sometimes we just show up somewhere, turn on our tape recorders, and see what happens.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what are you kidding me?
Like, at this car dealership, trying to sell its monthly quota of cars, and it is not going well.
I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Real life stories every week.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for HPR comes from Still End Moving Center, offering Lomi Lomi Massage, Sarga Bodywork, Yoga Body Alignment, and other spa services. Information at stillendmovingcenter.com/massage.
Like it or not, there is a new look to Hawaii's driver's license. It's the first major change to the design in 17 years, and it includes 50 new security features to prevent identity theft. The Department of Customer Services says the new design aims to capture the spirit of Hawaii. HPR's Kevin Allen and Addis Belai took to the streets of downtown Honolulu to see what people think of the redesign. Javik, on her way to work in downtown Honolulu, was delighted with the new look.
First take, how do you feel?
I like it, actually. I like it.
What do you like about it?
It's more pastel than the current one. I don't know, it just kind of seems prettier.
We can't see it right now, but on the other side, there's the state fish, the humuhumunukunukuapua'a. Oh. But what would you want to put there, or if you could add something to it?
Oh, brother. You know, I like the flowers, plumeria, or something like that. I like the new one.
And Joshua from Makaha prefers the original design and the nostalgia that came with it.
I like the color. I mean, something different from the original one. But my honest opinion, I prefer the old one.
Why do you prefer the old one?
Because I feel like that's the original one that, you know, everybody, I mean, everyone likes, you know. I mean, that's my own opinion. I don't know how other people feel about it. To see the original that, you know, that we've been known for so long, taken away.
I mean, how does that make you feel, just kind of everything changing right now with the design?
Honestly, it's sad, you know, to see the original colors that we've been known for so long get taken away just like that. I feel like they should do, like, you know, like a vote or something to see how everybody, you know, will feel about it and go from there. Instead of just changing it like that, you know? Get a feedback from the community before they change it.
Yeah.
But the fact that they can go ahead and just change it like that, it's kind of mind-boggling.
And Brian and his wife Gigi found that when they look at the new design, they don't really think of Hawaii.
The new one is nice and colorful and it's bright. It kind of, in my opinion, it doesn't really make me think of Hawaii too much. Like when it had the islands on it, you know, you instantly know where it's from, and the rainbow on it, kind of, it's just like a general, it's real pretty. It's nice and bright, but I'd like to see the island, so.
You can, I mean, it seems like I know what you're gonna say now, but if you could make like one change to it, what would you want to add onto the ID?
I would probably put the islands back on, either that or maybe an outrigger, a canoe with a group of people on there paddling, or maybe a local food, maybe something that a lot of people love to eat.
Nice spam musubi on there.
Yeah, or maybe a puka shell necklace or a tiki. Maybe everybody knows what a tiki is.
I would like to see the king Kamehameha on there.
Okay, but don't judge a card by its rainbow. Kim Hoshiro is the director of the city's Department of Customer Services. She says the IDs were long overdue for an update.
So it has been 17 years since our last update for our driver's licenses and state ID cards. And really, the whole focus has been to transition to a new state-of-the-art driver's license design to better protect residents against identity theft and counterfeiting. So that's our main focus. And in doing that, part of that transition has been this new card design. The materials that these new cards are made out of, it's 100% polycarbonate material. It's much harder and difficult to tamper with or deface. And also the current cards, because they're layers of paper, glue, and laminate, if they become wet or, you know, they can actually start separating. So these new cards are a solid piece of polycarbonate and they should be a lot more durable.
Well, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit more, too, about the security features. I think that's something that, you know, I know there's like a lot of reasons why there's a black and white photo, right, instead of a color photo. Is that a part of the security details? Can you talk to me a little bit more about maybe kind of what's under the hood protecting people's identity?
Yes, it's not just cosmetic, right? It really is a service upgrade that protects citizens and prevents security threats. So one of the things that you mentioned is the laser engraved photo. So it is black and white. It's laser engraved, as well as the data on the cards is laser engraved onto the polycarbonate card. So it's no longer printed like you would be able to print something with just a regular printer at home. It also has other security features built into it that you can't even see with the naked eye. So TSA security will be able to see different kinds of enhancements to the card when you're going through the checkpoint. And any kind of law enforcement or bank, if they have the technology, they will be able to see these various security features. We do have not only the laser engraved photo and the data on the card, but there are tactile kinds of engraving on the card where you feel things with your fingertips. That's hard to replicate, right? And then also some of the design elements where under certain kind of lighting, you'd be able to see it, but like I mentioned, not with the naked eye. So those are all part of the card now, and that will enable tampering and counterfeiting to be a lot more difficult. At the same time, we just want our customers to know that if they have a recently renewed card, those cards are still valid and secure until the end of the expiration period. They do not have to come in and get a replacement. In fact, we have an online process now where we don't want to tie up in-office service with things that we can do online. So we can get a duplicate online. Can't renew yet. We're working on online renewals. But you can get a duplicate now. And there's an online portal. You type in information. It's $7 that you pay through with a credit card. But that way you get your card in the mail and you continue to utilize your current card. And when you get your new card, then we ask that you return your invalid card at that point and begin to use the new card.
And I think for a lot of people, this news maybe came out of nowhere, but I'm sure this has been a process that's been going on for a long time, this design process. Who did you guys reach out to, and did you guys consult with anyone for this new car design? And can you tell me a little bit more about, I guess, the process that this went through to kind of reach this end product?
So all of the four county DMVs and the state DOT did a lot of the work in coming up with this design. And the intent was to carry over the rainbow, the iconic rainbow on our license plates and our previous IDs, but in this new format, and it's a new take on a classic design. But it actually has been in the works for quite some time. We started about a year and a half ago. And like I mentioned, it was part of our card production upgrade project, which we're still working on. But this is the first phase of that to put out these new cards. And the county DMVs invested a lot of time and energy into the new card design, and they worked very collaboratively to come up with it. And it's the first new design since 2009.
Right. And from a security standpoint, were you guys looking at a nationwide level? And did you guys consult anyone specifically for the security and kind of what's under the hood?
Yes. So the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, or AMVA, which is the national DMV association, they have standards that they issue for driver's license and state IDs. And so with these new cards, we are meeting all of the enhanced security upgrade requirements. So that's good. And because our previous card or the current card design uses older laminated material in its construction, as we mentioned, it is susceptible to peeling. So having these cards be a solid 100% polycarbonate matter will enable us to apply the various security elements like the laser engraving, microprint, holograms, and making the IDs hopefully almost impossible to modify, duplicate, simulate.
And is there anything else that people maybe should know about this card? We're going to do two parts. from a fun side of things, any little Easter eggs, things you'd like to share, little design elements? I know there's a Humu Humu Nuku Nuku Apua'a on the back. I think that's adorable. But then on a more serious note, I mean, is there anything that people should know, I guess, from like a change in duration of validity?
Yeah, so I think the black and white photo is something that people are going to need to get used to. But if you think about your passport, if you have one, those passport photos are very regulated in terms of it has to be black and white. You can't smile. For us, we're going to continue to allow people to smile, but the photo will be black and white. Once we upgrade fully to our new system, there will be streamlined processes that enhance the customer experience when they come into our location so that it's faster overall. That's really what we want, people to come to our location and leave very quickly, right? And that's what they're looking for.
Leave also. Smiling. Yeah.
Yes, leave smiling. So, you know, I think thinking about the black and white photo and enhanced security similar to a passport is a very good way to look at the driver's license state IDs, because it is a government issued ID, right? And then also having, you know, some of the new features, like you said, I hope people do enjoy seeing the state fish and then the coral reef on the back. The current cards do not have, you know, any kind of design really on the back. It's just white with a barcode and some data. But we wanted to add representation of the natural beauty of our state. So that is why those design elements were incorporated into the card while retaining some of the classic elements on the front. So the rainbow and then even the state flag, which is a hologram.
Well, just kind of finishing things up. I mean, overall, you know, the card's out there. How do you feel about what came out of this project?
Yeah, we feel good that we're able to offer this new card design to the community. We hope that they like it and they are excited to have the new cards. It just started being released on customers as early as last Friday. We're getting these new cards. And I think as more and more people see it, I hope that they will appreciate, yes, the work that went into this. And also to know that it's a very unique card. Someone told me that, yeah, they're not going to get it confused with any other card in their wallet, and it'll be easy to identify and pull out. So that's a good feature also.
That was Kim Hoshiro, director of the city's Department of Customer Services. She spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about the redesign of the new state IDs and the driver's license. Look for links to learn more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. HPR flashes back to bring you oldies but goodies. Kanakapila Sunday Vintage is a compilation of interviews, and it's thanks to host Eric Malama. D.W. Gibson is producing the series, which just rolled out this month. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
Yes. And so tell us about how this all came to be. I mean, I know we were chatting about, you know, HPR does great stuff, and we need to hanaho some of this to reach the ears that maybe didn't hear it the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. The conversation is no stranger to this, right? HPR has been doing great work for decades. And I remember when I moved to Hawaii a decade ago, Derek Malama on Kanakapila Sunday was one of the first things I remember. And I know that I'm not alone. And to think that was like some kind of more than halfway point. He'd already been doing it over a decade at that point. We've got 24 years of this show. Derek hosted it for over 19 years. And you're going back to the early 2000s. And it's just a treasure trove of an archive of Hawaiian music at the beginning of the 21st century. Derek talked to the biggest artists, some of the upcoming names at the time, and it's a chronicle of what was happening in music, sort of traditions that were coming out of Hawaiian Renaissance into the 21st century.
Well, you know, we were fortunate enough, Derek, to have Robert Casimero in studio with us. And as he walked in, he was drooling as we walked past the Atherton because he remembered that fabulous piano that he played on years ago. he just had so many wonderful memories. And to know that HPR has that connection with the musicians and that you helped to, you know, foster that relationship.
Yes. The first interview, actually, is with the brothers Casimiro. And it's sad, actually, because Roland is no longer with us. I was able to talk to them. And that first interview, I actually went to the Mountain Apple Studios, which are not around anymore. And I was able to have just a regular conversation. I was a little intimidated.
Starstruck.
Yes, starstruck. Because they were just, you know, a few feet away from me, like you are and DW are for me right now. But they were singing at the same time and talking as well. And we got to know that we were both from Kalihi. So you'll find that in the first episode of the podcast. So we talk about what it was like to be from Kalihi. And they play three songs. That was part of what I wanted to get out of the musicians, besides a talk story, to get three songs from everyone. And
you succeed, I think.
I think so, yeah. That was, you know, in my mindset there. So,
well, it was just lovely because, you know, walking through our hallway, Robert said, oh, and I just think of Roland. And it was special to him. And he wants to come back and play in the Atherton. So I think that's awesome. And I was fortunate to see him at three events this year. And to think, you know, he's been around for 50 years. And he talked about what it was like closing at the Royal Hawaiian, you know, when they played their last show there. And just to think of that rich musical history. And so I'm just pleased that we're able to resurrect these interviews that Derek did.
Yeah, and there's so much great lineage. People talk about the musicians that came before them, and a true Kanakapila sessions in garages on a Wednesday night, you know, learning slack key style of playing. And just personalities come out. There's so much levity when you're talking, Derek, to the brothers Casimiro. There's a great moment where they ask you what time the show will air.
I know.
You tell them Sunday afternoon and they're like, oh, that's morning for us. So,
you know, that was great the moments. Early days of the show when nobody knew that we had that show on. And actually, not too many people could hear the station. We were on KIPO, which had a weaker signal. But
it's different now.
Yes, we're all across, you know, the state. But back then, nobody could hear us, hardly. Mm.
And I think something happened to the show over time because, you know, we have over 70 shows archived, and I listened to a lot of them. And as the show goes along in years, you can tell that musicians do know the show more and more. And it becomes sort of a center post for a community of people making music in the islands. And I can hear in people's voices sort of the excitement of coming on the air with you as the show gained its reputation and its place in the community.
Yes. And I had a great time with them, talking to them, learning more about them. And listening to them, I mean, I just felt very privileged that they were coming down to our station, and I spent time up there in the Atherton, just me being the audience, just them playing for me. So,
oh my gosh,
yeah, I know.
What a privilege that was, right? Oh my gosh,
right.
So, private concert,
and Keola Beamer and Raiatea around the second episode.
That's this week's episode. Yeah.
This week's episode. And it was amazing to have. I mean, it's never going to happen again, I don't think, where Keola Beamer and Raiatea will be playing. Maybe it will, but that was kind of a unique thing that happened back then because they had a CD out called Keola Beamer and Raiatea. And Keola actually spoke about 9/11. Wow. Where he had been on tour on the West Coast and what had happened right after that. You know, when all the airports were shut down.
Yes.
And he has a story about how people wanted to get together and hear music.
And connect with each other.
Right.
Because we'd just gone through this terrible thing as a country.
Yeah. So he tells that story and at the end of that interview, we have a recording of Imagine in Hawaiian. So that's kind of puts gorgeous. It all together. Yeah.
Powerful.
Yeah, it's powerful. Gorgeous, right? Hey, singing that song in Hawaiian is just absolutely gorgeous. And there's an intimacy between the two of them. They really developed a sweet relationship, and they tell the story of how they met at the lantern lighting festival on Memorial Day. And Gila talks about what drew him to Raiatea's voice. And that's a great example, because those are two different generations in Hawaiian music, and their connection on that album is really strong.
Yeah, and you can feel it.
Well, okay, and what else is on tap?
We've got some other great artists coming on, yeah.
John DeMello. He had produced at that time Israel Kamakaviva'ole, a CD called Wonderful World.
Yes,
so it took the best of Iz, and he kind of remixed the music with orchestral sounds, with the violin, yes. You know, with an orchestra. So he was talking about that. And then he was talking about the person who wrote White Sandy Beach. So
great
he has the story.
Story.
Yeah, the story of how that song came to be. And you'll love that story. And Natalie Aikamau is also on there, not in a different podcast, as well as Amy Hanaili'i and Jeff Peterson. They did a CD called Amy and Slack Key Masters of Hawaii. And you'll love that, because we played just about every song from that CD on that podcast.
And Kavika as well?
Yeah, Kavika Kahiapo, who learned how to play from Gabby Pahinui. So he talks about his days in Waimanalo. And
tells a great story of the first time his dad put a guitar in his lap and he felt the vibrations of the music against his body and how powerful that was. It's a really great story.
Yeah. See, it's all coming back to me now. I sort of kind of forgot after all these years.
No, but it's just wonderful. It's like sipping a good glass of wine, you know, vintage, right? You're just thinking, wow, it's
very good.
So rich and so complex and just a wonder to behold again. And for the folks that maybe heard it once, just to bring back those feelings. And for the folks who haven't heard it, boy, you're in for a treat, right?
Absolutely, yeah. People who will have been listening to the show forever, this will be a fantastic revisit for them. It'll be fresh and new and all of those things you just described, Catherine. And I'm not one of those people that knew all of those years of the show. So hearing a lot of these older shows was new for me. And what an education, what an awesome experience getting exposed to all of these musicians. Just really rich.
Well, you know, I remember at the Gallery Iolani where they had an exhibit of Robert Cozumero's 50 years, right? And I asked him if he had a favorite photo, and he said there was one, and it was a backyard party, and they were playing music. And that's what Kanakapila is all about,
right?
Playing music.
Exactly. Glad we gave it the right title there.
All right. Well, lots to look forward to. But thank you so much for carving out time for us and sharing the story with our listeners.
Thank you much.
We've been hearing from HPR's Derek Malama and D.W. Gibson. They've just launched a podcast, Kanakapila Vintage. It's a series of some of the best interviews over 2.5 decades of the show, Kanakapila Sunday. The second episode is out today, featuring Keola Beamer and Raiatea Helm. And the entire series will be rebroadcast on HPR's airwaves in August. And we are out of time today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show planned around planes, trains, and automobiles. Start your engines. Call our Talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.